Welcome to episode 3 of Human Nature, Buddha Nature. I'm your host, Caspalita Thompson. Everyone calls me Casper. This is a Bright Earth Buddhism podcast. And today, most of the episode is a conversation that I had with Satya about her journey to Buddhism. I'm interested at the moment in the different stories that people have of how they found their way to this tradition, to any Buddhist tradition. They're all so different, and yet there are some common markers, usually some dissatisfaction, encountering something inspiring, something that brings curiosity, or maybe there is something different to the life I have now that is sort of trustworthy enough, and then something new happening, something unexpected. But the specifics of it, they're so unique to each person. When we're thinking about how to let people know about the practices that we do and so on, how to welcome people to the temple. And I think of all the different ways that people have actually made it through the doors. You couldn't replicate most of them, whether it's the road closure that led to the traffic jam that frustrated Kama, so she pulled in to the temple. Or when I was working in Waterstones years ago and Jame asked me for a book recommendation. You can't plan those things. Anyway, I know some of Satya's story already, but I was curious to hear more. So we sat in the garden and recorded it on location, which is, it's a mixed blessing, right? It means that I can't really edit the conversation afterwards. It means you get to hear things like a pigeon taking off and the fountain from the small pond behind us, and occasionally a bit of wind on the microphone, I'm afraid, which I'm really sorry about, but I'm still including the conversation despite that. In a studio, with all the editing, it's really easy to make yourself sound wise, or at least articulate, because you can cut out the ums and ahs and re-record things. And just with my Zoom H2 microphone on location, it records everything all at once, all the background noise as well as the voices. So I can't cut it because you'll hear the jump. But that's also a blessing, right? Because we're real people, and hopefully some of that comes across. At one point, I jump in with the name of Suzuki Roshi's autobiography, which is partly trying to be helpful and partly just me showing off. It's a little bit of greed for what exactly, people knowing I know things. It doesn't paint me in the best of lights. And if I was in the studio, I could edit that out and you'd never know about it. But, you know, here I am, a flawed human being. I'm reminded of the Zen koan. It's almost like a haiku. It goes something like this: maple leaf floating to the ground, front side, back side. And what I take from that is, like, we so often just show the front of ourselves allegorically, metaphorically. We show our best faces to the world. But the practice of Buddhism, the road to becoming enlightened, is to know the front of the leaf, to know the back of the leaf, to be happy that both of those things are being seen. Our better natures and our worse natures, they all have to be included. You can't miss anything out if you're stepping into the spiritual path. Anyway, what else do you need to know going in? Oh, at one point, Satya mentions the Amida Order. That's the group that we were both a part of when we met. We left in 2020 to set up Bright Earth Buddhism. Oh yeah, and maybe think about the parallels in your own life. Like, Satya's journey will be very different to yours, but some of that movement from dissatisfaction to curiosity, something of that will be similar, even if the way she expresses it and some of the words she uses are very different. Maybe that's enough of a setup. So we're going to go over to the garden where I'm talking to Satya, and then afterwards we'll have our pop culture moment. So I know the first Buddhist group you went to was a Zen group, is that right?
It is.
Can you tell me how you got there?
How did I get there? I think that I had read, just to rewind a little bit, I had found quotes online that I really liked the sound of, and they were all by someone called Pema Chodron. So I looked her up and saw she was Buddhist, and I was talking to a friend at the time about being interested in Buddhism, and he recommended Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki Shunryu. And in introducing it, he said to me, which was really helpful, that he didn't really understand much of it, but that didn't matter too much because I didn't either. But there was something about the book that was cast a little spell on me somehow. There was something interesting and I didn't really know what it was. And I knew that he was Zen, so I over time looked up what Buddhist groups were around me in Reading at the time. The first temple I went to was actually, I think in retrospect, is probably Tibetan. There was a lot of colour. This is a long time ago now, and a massive shrine with lots and lots of offerings on it. That just freaked me out completely because I was coming from atheism. I was coming from extreme self-sufficiency and secular kind of place. So the Zen place I went to was less scary. It was just an ordinary terraced house in an ordinary Reading street. And I can remember coming to a retreat day and sitting in the waiting room with some men. I can't remember anything else about them. They were all men. And we were all sitting very quietly. And the priest who ran the house came into the room and kind of said, "Oh, were you also miserable looking for?" I thought, oh, I like her. She had a very crinkly smile and she just kind of exuded warmth, which I really appreciated. And I can remember from that day, I can remember just a couple of things really. The sort of the surprise at meditating looking at a wall. I'd not heard about that before and it felt like a very strange thing to do. I can remember her not reprimanding somebody, but showing someone how to put the service books on the floor. She did it herself. She modelled how we place them carefully on the floor with care, because it's a way of respecting the container, respecting the Buddha, I guess I would say now. And I can also remember doing the work period and trying to scrub bits of kind of splattered on fat from around the cooker and totally failing, and I felt like a real failure of a Buddhist because I couldn't get many of the dots off. And I can also remember that we had a bring and share lunch and everyone else had got these amazing homemade Tupperware boxes full of beautiful food and I bought something from M&S. But it wasn't right. It wasn't right for me quite. I went to a couple of things and tried to latch on, I guess. And I can remember writing to her and saying something like this, like I was kind of trying to connect or trying to come. And she said, "Oh, maybe just if it's not right, don't force it," which I thought was a real gift because it was her group. And I imagine that she wanted new people in her group. We certainly want new people in our group. So I really appreciated that free. It was really about what was right for me And it was also a deep trusting that I would find my way to something, that I would find my way to the right spiritual container, I guess. Yeah.
Thank you. One of the first retreats I did, I was scrubbing the cooker and really wanted to get it right. And one of the monks came in and told me to stop doing it because I was trying too hard.
Brilliant.
Which I really appreciated. Like, yeah. That's enough. Now yeah. It's time to go and meditate again.
Nice.
That was at Throstle Hole. And I think your group was an OBC group.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
I think it's really hard as people who have been doing this for a long time to imagine how it is for a beginner. That's partly why I'm curious about this topic. It requires quite a leap out of what is known and familiar to us now. And I'm wondering if there's anything else that stands out about that time when you think of kind of the experience of, like you talked about, the Tibetan temple freaking you out and the experience of someone who doesn't know anything arriving in a place.
I think there's something about trust. How do I know that I can trust these people and in particular the person that's leading? How do I know that I can trust these teachings or this way of life? And at the time, I didn't have a sense of faith at all. I didn't have any experience of my own of connection to the divine. And so I was entirely dependent on other people to show me that, or to show me the things that they did that helped them in their own relationship with that. And people are fallible.
Yeah, but there was, so initially, I guess, the books you read, there was something trustworthy or trustworthy enough about those. What was it that felt reliable about, you know, Pema Chodron or Suzuki Roshi?
So Suzuki Roshi, the book that really affected me was his biography.
Crooked Cucumber. By David Chadwick.
Yeah, thank you. I was just about to say that. I can remember reading that book and feeling that I'd actually met him, that I had hung out with him for a while, that I knew him a little bit. And he was, you know, he was also a human being, and I can remember he was a very strong-willed man and maybe caused himself harm sometime, well, did cause himself harm in some ways. Mm-hmm. Something that I find runs through, potentially, you know, runs through Japanese culture or can run through religious culture, some forms of Christianity. So that bit was... I didn't know about that bit, because I guess when we're first encountering these things, we maybe feel like we need to take it all in. Like that's the deal. Like if you want to be a Buddhist, you have to be like this person, or you have to do all these things if you're serious about it. But what really stayed with me from that book was his kindness and his steadiness and his really pure desire to make this offering to other people of something amazing that he'd received, that he just wanted them to have it too. And I think he was like the first opening between me and the Buddha, and I'm really grateful to him for that. He, you know, he was dead by the time I read the book, but if it wasn't for that book, I wouldn't be here with you.
Yeah, of course. Karma.
Karma. Yeah. It makes me wonder how much we can manipulate anything, really, because we were saying this the other day, weren't we? The way that people end up at Bright Earth Temple is so random. Like, you know, they read a book on holiday, or they... bump into someone in a bookshop, or the series of events that lead them to coming into our doors are so impossibly unpredictable.
Although occasionally somebody does see some of the publicity and come for that reason.
Yeah, the posters might work too.
Once in a while.
But you have to get the person in the right... Yeah. You're a particular person when you look at the poster, aren't you?
Yeah, the karma has to be ripe. Yeah. Like the fruit has to be ripe.
And I would never have gone to that Zen temple if I hadn't have had the lifetime's experience that I had. And then I would never have, you know, as the story goes on, I wouldn't have taken the next steps. So there's all kinds of causes and conditions working on us the whole time, I guess. I like to think that the Buddhas are just, you know, giving us a little nudge in one direction, a little nudge in the other direction, bringing things to our attention, but who knows?
Well, the Buddha reality is right here all the time, I guess.
Yeah.
And so is all the other things in life.
Yeah.
All the blindness that we...
there's lots of other nudges we get from other things.
So what was the next step after the Zen temple in Reading?
So probably the next big step was living with an alcoholic, I think. I went through years of discovering... I went through years of being faced with my limitations when it came to helping another being, my ex, and I was driven to the kind of the edge of despair and overwhelm, and walked into a group of people who met to help each other deal with being in relationship with an alcoholic. And from really early on in that group, I noticed that the people that I really kind of wanted to be like, the people I wanted to emulate, the people who seemed to be steady and laughing and full of kind of wisdom, were the ones that talked about a higher power, which was, what's that word, anathema?
Anathema.
Well, I don't know if I've ever have said it out loud. It was just the opposite of who I wanted to be or what I wanted to trust.
Yeah, before the recording, you were talking about how somehow the atheism went along with self-sufficiency.
Yeah, I was very self-sufficient and I was very atheist and I was very, very desperate. And it was only because of my desperation that I became willing to experiment with opening to something that I didn't know about and that other people seemed to know about, and listen to them and even imagine that I might not know everything, or that what I knew wasn't enough.
So desperation, but also seeing something that other people had.
It was that combination. It was the desperation, which pushed me out of my self-sufficient egg, my kind of tough shell, and it was warmth and care from other people that I went towards, I guess, those two things together.
And warmth, like the crinkly smile of the OBC monk in Reading, and like the feeling of being with Suzuki Roshi through his biography.
Yeah. And Rosie, who was my sponsor, who I'm still in touch with a little bit, really did care. She had something she'd received that she really wanted to pass on, and it had really worked for her in her life. And I could see that. I could see it not just in looking at what she said about her life or seeing her house, or, you know, I could experience it by being in her presence. And I learned from her, and I learned from the 12 steps. I learned a lot.
So what was it like to experiment with a higher power for the first time?
I just went through the motions to start with. So you're just told to just kind of almost invent a higher power and hand things over and ask for help. And mine was called Bob. And I just handed things over to Bob. I've got a little memory of sitting on the bed in the house where I lived with my ex and talking to Bob or handing something over to Bob and just kind of feeling really foolish. But I was still desperate, so I was just doing what I was told. And as time went on, something real emerged, something behind the pretending. They say fake it to make it in AA, and there was something of that nature to it. I was going through the motions of having a relationship with the divine. And then the divine stepped in, I guess. Like, here I am. I'm actually here. I'm not made up.
Yeah, strange.
Yeah. And that, and that's, you know, as I talk about it, it was a very, it was much more grey than that and much more fuzzy. But as I look back from here, I can see that that relationship definitely started during that time. So the relationship with the divine came first, and then Buddhism came later. And I think that's why I'm so happy to hear spiritual wisdom from different traditions, because I know that, that Buddhism is just one way of talking about that relationship. Mm.
So there was some experience of Buddhism that gave you some experience of care, but it didn't quite fit, or it wasn't quite right, and it sort of got put down for a while.
Yeah, the form, right? And the group was not the right group for me somehow. Okay. Or maybe it just wasn't the right time in my life. Yeah. Maybe I wasn't quite ripe yet.
Thinking of the tomatoes that, you know, were growing in the greenhouse, and that, you're just kind of testing, is it ready to come off the vine?
Yeah, today? And obviously if you pull it when it's not ready, it's green and bitter. So, you know, you can't rush that process.
Yeah, so she was right.
She was right, and I'm really great. I remember that email. Of the three or four things I can remember, must have been 30 years ago now. I remember that, the generosity of that email, and the faith in it, that she had faith that what was best for me would unfold without me pushing it. And I pushed and pushed and pushed for decades after that email. But that's one of the things that's been slow to ease and is easing now.
Little seed planted.
Yeah, amazing. We never know where those little seeds end up, do we? The little things that we offer. She wouldn't have done that in a self-conscious way. It was just the truth for her. It was just a very ordinary email, probably.
Yeah.
But she was lit up by the Buddha. And so I caught a little bit of that.
And then this gradual but powerful transformation that opened you up to some experience of the divine. And then at some point, having had that, picking up Buddhism or finding your way back to Buddhism again.
Well, I guess that it probably was a combination of the right time and the right container when I encountered the Amida Order and did my therapy training with them, met you. There was something about Pure Land Buddhism that immediately caught my interest, this idea of being a foolish being and the acceptance of our foolishness right in the center of what we do. Felt like the perfect antidote for my self-perfection, that's driving, that kind of needing to be more perfect. If I'm more perfect, then I'll be acceptable. And then I encountered this message which was like, no, you're acceptable right now. And that just blew my mind, and still blows my mind, that that can be possible, and that it's not dangerous. It doesn't lead people to degenerative kind of criminal activity. It doesn't give people permission to become worse versions of their self. In my experience, it actually allows them to grow into kinder versions of themselves, because there's a self-kindness as well. There's a forgiveness of ourselves, and that makes it easier to forgive others. So it was the right group. And again, you know, it's a human group, so humans are in it, and that's complicated. But I still think of finding the right group as a bit like finding a partner, if that's the kind of thing we want to do, that there are partners that are more or less good for us. And if we're lucky, we find someone that is a fit in certain ways.
Yeah, well, it's like we were saying earlier about karmic conditions versus the presence of the Buddha, right? The karmic conditions are such that the group suits you and works for you, and you can learn something, and there's rough edges and smooth edges.
Yeah.
And it works for a while, and then you let it go, or it doesn't work at all, and you don't pick it up, or it works for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's like there's that human reality alongside something which is present in all Buddhist groups and not in Buddhist groups, and here in the garden.
Absolutely. And I guess that for me, there's something really helpful about, I've been lucky to find a group that I can be loyal to, but it's been helpful to stick with it over a long period of time. And also the humanness, the fallibility is where we learn, is certainly where I've learned. So it's that combination of a container that helps me connect with the Buddha, which is the thing that doesn't go away and that isn't fallible, combined with a bunch of people who are also trying to connect with the Buddha, and trying to live as well as they can and making mistakes all over the place, just like I do. It's that combination, I think, that's worked so well. And it would be hard for me to maintain my connection with the Buddha if it wasn't for the group.
Yeah, thank you. That's important. There are Pratheka Buddhas, right? In the literature we read about them, people who practice on their own and become enlightened, but there aren't many of them. Most people need a Sangha.
Absolutely. And I'm just reflecting on the moments I've shared with you today in terms of my journey into Buddhism. None of them were connections with nature or with philosophy, or they were very human encounters. They were an encounter with the humanness of Suzuki Roshi, not his cleverness, not his Buddhist cleverness. It was the humanness of my sponsor. It was the humanness of the people I encountered in the Amida Order that helped me to trust enough, I think, to open enough to allow something different in.
Mm. And when you say humanness, picking up the words that you used earlier, kindness, caring, warmth, feeling accepted just as I am.
Yeah, being seen.
Steadiness.
Being allowed to be who I am, not just who the other person needs me to be. And witnessing their faith, witnessing their relationship with the divine, seeing them lit up by the Buddhas.
And I guess I'm hearing you talk and use the word divine and faith quite repeatedly, and I'm remembering how firmly atheist you told me you were and self-sufficient, and just noticing the gap between those things, and for some people listening, hearing those words might be really challenging as well. And I wonder if there's anything you would say to those people.
Yeah, so I guess I would suggest, if you want to find your own Bob.
Find your own Bob. Heard it here first.
Just experiment with the idea of not knowing everything, of there being some kind of benevolent mystery. Fake it to make it for a little while.
Yeah, it doesn't have to
be. It could be nature.
Personified.
It could be the spirit of the group. It could be a wise ancestor. Come into relationship with something that is not you. and that you can lean on a little bit and just see what that feels like.
Yeah.
But don't go too fast, or don't push anything.
Yeah.
Like if it's not right, that's fine.
You have to be ripe, everybody listening.
You have to be ripe.
Yeah, and you were ripe to read those books. Like, in a sense, they were higher powers or other powers, we say in Kyanand Buddhism.
Yeah.
They took you beyond what you knew already, and you had to trust a bit. Like, is that right?
Absolutely.
Can you foot on this steady ground or not?
You have to step out. You have to step off the... I mean, the Zen 100-foot pole that you have to step off, you know, maybe that's a bit much, but you do have to step off a 1-foot pole.
Yeah.
And trust that you'll be held, and be curious. Just be curious about what's happening in you, what's happening in other people.
And the only way to step off the pole is by stepping off the pole.
Absolutely. But there are people that know how to... There are people who've done it.
Yeah,
and they're quite helpful to hang out with.
Yeah, and to see other people. And their steadiness is the word that
find the people that you want to be like.
Yeah.
And copy them.
Their confidence in the Dharma is... well, we talk about transmission, right, often thinking very formally about teacher-disciple, but sometimes I think it's more like a radio signal. It just beams out, and you have to be in the area, and you can...
You have to be in the area. You can catch it. You have to tune in. You have to have the right dial.
Yeah, but there are people broadcasting signals, and what they're broadcasting is their confidence.
Yeah, absolutely.
In something else.
Absolutely. And, you know, anyone that's 100% confident 100% of the time, maybe stay away from them. Because
we're all fallible.
Because we're all fallible. But, there is wisdom out there, and there is compassion out there, and we can lean into it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Thanks to Satya for talking to me about those beginnings. We'll have more guests on the podcast talking about other things in the future. But for now, it's time for this episode's pop culture moment. This episode's pop culture moment is a sad one. Earlier this week, Dolly Parton died, and I found myself quite unexpectedly affected. It really knocked me sideways. A deep outpouring of grief flowed out of me, and I would never have described myself as a Dolly Parton fan. I always enjoyed her songs when they came on the radio, but I didn't seek them out. But she was a bright spot in the landscape of the world, and somehow stood for something hopeful for me, and I was really affected when I heard the news that she'd died. It was only then, on reading lots and lots of different eulogies and obituaries, and that I learned some followers used to call her the Dolly Lama for the sort of the wisdom that she used to offer, whether it was in titbits or in the way that she lived her life. And I saw another commenter say, she was so loved because she loved everybody else. And I thought, oh, isn't that the perfect description of a Buddha? She loved everybody else. And that's why she was loved. And, you know, I don't know a lot about her personal life. I never met her and we never hung out. And yet, I did get that feel from her, and that's very powerful. Satya and I talked about transmission earlier, and it can happen in that way as well, right? You're inspired by another loving being on the other side of the world and the music she creates, and somehow that rubs off on you a little bit. So maybe Dalai Lama was appropriate. In in Shin Buddhism, which is the largest school of Pure Land Buddhism in Japan, when someone dies who has been a Shin Buddhist, well, the same, you know, the same as in Bright Earth Buddhism, we trust that they've been reborn in the Pure Land. And what that means for many Japanese families is that an ancestor becomes a personal Buddha. Jane Naomi Iwamura puts it like this: the faithful, upon death, pass on to Amida's Pure Land, Sukhavati, where they enter a world of non-suffering and eventually attain Buddhahood. The deceased person is given a new name, Homyo, recognizing their spiritual transformation and enlightenment, and is referred to more generally as Hotoke, literally Buddha. This is from the chapter Grave Remembrance, which is in a book called Emergent Dharma, Asian American Feminist Buddhists on Practice, Identity and Resistance, edited by Sharon A. Su, PhD. Iwamura also, the whole chapter is about how she visits the graves of her ancestors and takes her children with her. And she describes learning this kind of connection with ancestors from within her own family. And at one point, she describes it, learning it particularly from her grandmother. She says, "My father's mother, Natsuye, was especially devout, and her devotion was built into the care she took with her family, and especially my grandfather. When my grandfather was alive, my grandmother would shred the carrots, bundle these shreds into a cheesecloth, and painstakingly squeeze a cup of carrot juice to nourish her ailing husband. When he died, she took care in arranging his memorial service and maintaining his memory at her butsudan." That's the shrine, like the home shrine. "In addition to these practices, her day included setting a place at the table for my deceased grandfather and having conversations with him. This seemed odd to me at first, but as I grew accustomed to this ritual, I would come to appreciate my grandfather's continuing presence and my grandmother's love for him through this gesture. The daily place settings and conversations were my grandmother's way of taking care of my grandfather, even as he has passed on to the Pure Land. Through my grandmother's actions, I learned that death does not mean the end of our relationships with one another." Later, she quotes Paula Arai's book, Bringing Zen Home, which is about Paula Arai's study of lay women in Japan. And I feel like I already mentioned that on the podcast. Or maybe it was a talk I did. Anyway, Iwamura writes, "In her study of Zen Buddhist women practitioners in Japan, Paula Arai recognizes how the dead are transformed into personal Buddhas who play an important role in the process of healing and spiritual cultivation of the living. She notes, recognizing the deceased as personal Buddha means the living and dead are not separated. The concept of personal Buddha takes the teaching of interrelatedness and stretches it across the illusory boundaries of life and death. Intimate relations people have with their personal Buddhas function to dissolve the delusion of separate entities." Whatever you think of life after death, whether our consciousness in some way is transformed into a Buddha or simply dissolves into reality itself, this suggests that some kind of relationship is possible with an enlightened ancestor. Whether that enlightened ancestor is carried in our own hearts or in the universe somewhere is less important, I think, than the experience of being inspired, the experience of knowing there is a source of wisdom that we can call on. For me, there's something very moving about this way of understanding the world, whether or not it is quote unquote true or not, to have my own personal Buddha would be a powerful practice, I think. Whether it's one of my own enlightened ancestors, whether it's a figure from Buddhist history, or whether it's Dolly Parton. Thanks for joining us and following my curiosity. Hopefully something meaningful here for you as well. Do remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from for news about what's coming up at the temple online and in person. Check out the calendars at brightearth.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at that website or directly on the show website at humannaturebuddhanature.com. And as always, I'll sign off by saying thank you.